singing, just the hand claps.
Singing was good.
I like the singing.
Hi, this is Mark Ruffalo, and you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra.
Wayfarm respectfully and humbly acknowledges the past, present, and future Indigenous peoples on whose ancestral lands Wayfarm and our radio station, WGXC, operate and broadcast. The Mohicans named themselves the people of the waters that are never still, following their arrival along the Mohicanitta, the great ebb tide river, also known as the Hudson. The Mohicans stewarded this land over many generations in dynamic communication and interaction with diverse Indigenous peoples, including the Haudenosaunee Mohawk and the Munsee Lenape. Mohican descendants today live in communities in Ontario, Wisconsin, and Oklahoma. For further information on Mohican history and the contemporary community of the Stockbridge Munsee Band of Mohican Indians, please visit Mohican.com.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Upstate Films, where membership provides access to world-class cinema, first-run feature films, art house films, live music, and more, plus advance notice of close-up series conversations with directors and actors and other special events at the Star Theatre in Rhinebeck, the Orpheum in Saugerties, and traveling around the Hudson Valley. Information at upstatefilms.org. That's upstatefilms.org.
Wayfarm's WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of E-Team in South Carolina, New York. WGXC monthly supporters care deeply about Creative Community Radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Brendan J. Lyons reports in the Times Union that on February 12th, Republican Representative Elise Stefanik filed a formal complaint against Democrat State Attorney General Letitia James, alleging investigation and prosecution of Donald J. Trump was biased, complaining about, and I quote, highly inappropriate and prejudicial comments, end quote, against the former president during his recent trial on civil fraud charges in New York. Stefanik complaint states, and I quote, Ms. James' comments as Attorney General and as a candidate for Attorney General adversely reflect on her fitness as a lawyer and implicate the rules of professional conduct, end quote. The Attorney General's office declined to respond with a comment on Stefanik's complaint. The Attorney Grievance Committee decides what happens next. The investigations are confidential, so they could dismiss the issue without the public knowing, or they could privately issue a letter of advisement or admonition. If the committee believes there may be professional misconduct, a case could be referred to the appellate division of the state Supreme Court for a formal disciplinary proceeding. Stefanik cites previous comments from James in her 2018 election night victory speech, where she vowed to shine, and I quote, a bright light into every dark corner of his real estate dealings, end quote. She later pledged to, and I quote, use every area of the law to investigate President Trump and his business transactions and that of his family as well, end quote. Meanwhile, the former president and his family are awaiting a decision from Judge Arthur Engoron about allegations Trump lied about his wealth on financial statements to banks and insurance companies. He could be fined up to $370 million and get banned from engaging future business dealings in New York's real estate market. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Paul Kirby reports in the Daily Freeman that the agenda for the February 15th meeting of the New York State Independent Redistricting Commission says the group will vote on a 2024 congressional map. But the public will not be able to see that map. Karen Blatt, co-executive director of the commission, said, and I quote, the map will be made available to the public on our website on Thursday after the vote, end quote. The full state legislature, controlled by Democrats, would have to approve the map. Congressional map lines are supposed to be drawn every 10 years after the census. But New York's congressional maps have been in and out of court several times, and now the map used for the 2022 election is being replaced. Which party controls the majority in the House of Representatives this fall may be decided in the Hudson Valley swing districts, and the new map may alter that outcome. Read more about this story in the Daily Freeman. Tatiqua Penix and Ashley Clemens report for WNYT that at a meeting on February 13th, Albany County Democrats declined to endorse a candidate for district attorney. Instead, Albany County Democrat Chair Jacob Crawford said that local defense attorney Lee Kendlon will be interviewed by the executive committee for the position of district attorney. Incumbent Albany County District Attorney David Soares had been running unopposed and expected to receive the endorsement. But he recently has been criticized for using grant money to give himself a $22,000 bonus. Soares says he did nothing wrong and released a video statement saying he does plan to return the grant money. Albany County Comptroller Susan Rizzo has contacted the Attorney General's office and the state comptroller about investigating Soares. Soares and Kendlon both attended the meeting. Read more about this story at WNYT. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Thursday, February 15th. Local early morning temperatures range from 13 degrees in Tannersville to 21 in Kinderhook. Average soil temperature is 35 degrees. Today will be cold with a high of 36 degrees by 1 p.m. Around 4 p.m., light snow is expected to enter the area and continues through the night, dropping maybe a half inch by morning. Tomorrow, despite a high of 39 degrees, conditions will be sub-freezing because the winds will be gusty and getting into all those nooks and crannies. Overnight, the winds die down and we see a low of 25 degrees. Saturday is expected to have light snow all day with a high of 35. Sunday will be cloudy with a high of 36 and a chance for light afternoon snow. Sunset today will be at 5:13 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 6:48 a.m. Looking way up, we see X-class flare chances are at 15%. Plasma winds will be slow at 383 kilometers per second with a thin density of 2 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 4 megahertz till dark, then fair across the board overnight. There are no chances for aurora this evening. The current sunspot number is 123. And this has been The Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
All right, you are tuned into the WGXC Morning Show. I'm Tom Rowe here in Hudson today, and I'm joined by the Times Union Hudson Valley reporter, Roger Hannigan-Gilson, who stops by every Thursday or calls in every Thursday and lets us know what he's been working on. Let's see.
I think this mic is on for you.
Is this mic on?
Yes.
Yes. Wonderful. Hello. Hi, Tom.
So what have you been up to this week?
You know, anticipating snow and then being disappointed. That was kind of funny. We thought we were going to get slammed, so the whole Hudson Valley crew was like up and at them early, and I woke up and I'm like, huh, not a flake on the ground. But it was interesting, like the split between the snow was so severe. Is I live in Saugerties, and Saugerties didn't get anything. But then in Kingston, it was snowing, and that's like a 10-mile difference. And then if you went down to like Newburgh and Orange County, like the like Middletown got like 10 inches.
That's where the big snow that they thought was going to be up here fell.
Yeah, I guess the whole pattern shifted southwards. I was talking to my mother who lives in Southern Connecticut, and she got quite a bit of snow too. That was where like the major band was. But yeah, it shifted south of here. Other than that,
it hasn't been much of a winter.
It hasn't. This morning is wintry. It's cool. Like a nice winter's day, as long as you stay inside. It looks nice, it just doesn't feel nice. But, you know, over the last week, some stuff I was working on. Dog abandonment, that happy subject.
Seems to be a couple cases lately.
Yeah, there. The thing is there's more cases than you would think because, you know, as I was preparing for the article, I was just searching, you know, because the Columbia Green Humane Society, they cover both Columbia and Green counties. They're, you know, they're not actually SPCA, but, you know, they act as the, I don't want to say clearinghouse for dogs, but, you know, it's a very nice organization. Ron Perez is great.
There's a new group in Greene County trying to start one for just Greene County, too.
That might be helpful. I mean, just because it's a ways to, well, I guess it's in Greenport from Greene County. But, yeah, I mean, we hear some stories about dog abandonment. There's been a couple recently. One was Barney the dog, who was found wandering along Route 23 limping badly. Somebody, like a parent that was either picking up or dropping off their kid from Taconic Hills, saw the dog and assumed it had been hit by a car because, you know, Barney couldn't put any weight on his leg. What turned out is the dog had developed bone cancer in that leg, and it was very visible in pictures of it. You know, his leg is like four times the size of it should be. The dog was taken in, and unfortunately there was no saving it. It's a terminal disease if not treated, and it certainly was not treated, so they had to humanely euthanize him. But that's just really the latest case. There were, I guess, three cases that the Columbia Grain Humane Society dealt with over the last few years in which there was like an abandoned dog that had obviously been maltreated. And, you know, they put out press releases and we wrote stories and there was rewards offered. A, the owners of these three dogs were never found. And when I talked to Ron Perez from the Columbia Grain Humane Society, he revealed that they found 100 dogs each year that were never claimed, and one can assume that those dogs were abandoned. Like 100 a year in the Twin Counties. I talked to somebody from an SPCA in Orange County, and they don't, Dutchess County, and they don't cover the entire county. They only cover six towns, and they got about 50 a year. So the article is kind of about how difficult it is to find the owners. A, if you do find an owner, the owner can always just be like, oh, it must have wandered off. But finding the owner in the first place is difficult. When people dump dogs, they take the identifying, you know, the tags off. There's a couple other ways of finding the dog's owner. There's whether the dog was registered. Something like less than half of dogs are registered, although it is, you know, a law that you must register your dog with the municipality. It is. A lot of people don't know that they're supposed to do that. It's about public education, but the word really isn't 100% out there. So you figure if somebody's abandoning a dog, they're not a very good dog owner, and they're less likely than the average person to have their dog registered, and even less likely to have the dog chipped. So a lot of times when a dog is found, you know, they'll put the word out. If the dog truly has wandered off, usually the owners, you know, quite frantically claim them within 24 hours and are very grateful. But then there's the 100 dogs that are never claimed, and usually they are not registered. An additional problem is that people tend to abandon dogs when they are changing locations, and the most common reason for this is if they're moving or if they're evicted, which is kind of the even sadder story. But there's a lot of difficulty finding the owners, and even more prosecuting the owners. Because if you just take the raw and not 100% specific number of 100 dogs being abandoned each year, you know, 4 years, that's 400 dogs. None of the dog owners have been, you know, prosecuted. So the success rate is very low. And, you know, it's not – well, it's the dog abandoner's fault, but there's just all these complexities about finding the owners and then, like, having evidence to charge them and et cetera. So it is rarely achieved. It's rarely accomplished.
Yeah, you can, I guess, bring all kinds of issues in. You could say the affordable housing crisis is, like, you know, it's hard to find a place. It's hard to find a place if you have pets. It's very difficult to find
a
place.
Yeah. My colleague Maria Silva, who covers a bit farther south than me, she does a wonderful article about that very issue. When people, you know, their lease isn't renewed or they're evicted, like they're on the open market, and it's very difficult to find a place that takes pets. Most of those places, or almost all of them, need a pet deposit. Many of them charge an additional fee every month. What I've found out, and this is kind of an interesting wrinkle in it, is that a couple of people I talked to for the article suggested it was becoming even harder to find rentals that take pets because of a change in state law. It was a year or two ago that made it unlawful for homeowners insurance in the state to distinguish between dog breeds, like, you know, traditionally. And I think this is a bit unfair because I have a pit, but listings would say, like, no pit bulls or no large breeds, and the law made it...
No Irish need apply.
Yeah, yeah. No, pit bulls are like Irish people in the 1880s. But what this does is, what has been suggested to me from a couple of people from SPCAs is that... Instead, what landlords will do now is just say no dogs. Instead of saying, like, you can have most dogs but not these specific breeds, because the homeowner's insurance is unable to distinguish, therefore the landlord just says, like, no, nothing, because I don't want to pay extra in my homeowner's insurance for any kind of pet. And, you know, I'm unable to numerically, like, say, you know, like 20% more, but... anecdotally, that seems to be the case.
Yeah, and I mean, if everyone is reporting that they're struggling to find a place, that it's very difficult to find any place, and then you take off a giant chunk of the possible places on the market because they don't allow dogs, then you're obviously in a much more difficult spot.
Yeah, yeah, and people having to give up their dogs because they can't find a place that takes them, I mean, that's more prominent than dog abandonment, although, you know, perhaps some of the dogs that were abandoned, they, you know, it was the same situation. They couldn't find a place for them. But the Columbia Grand Humane Society takes, it's like 800 or 900 pets are, like, given to them a year. What's the term? You know, essentially because the owners can no longer take care of them. And a lot of the cases is because they can't find a place that will take them.
That's a lot of dogs.
Yeah. I mean, I was just blown away by the 100
number.
That they essentially, like, 100 dogs are found wandering a year and nobody claims them. It's very sad,
like,
for the
one
dogs.
Every 3 or 4 days. It's crazy.
Yeah, no. And, you know, you got to thank the dog control officers. They, the really great people. I talked to one of them before the article. It was the one who found the dog along Route 23. And, you know, he was telling me that I think it was last year, two pit bulls were found wandering along the side of the road. They were emaciated. They had been starved to near death, and he, you know, tried to save them, but one of them just passed away in his back seat while he was rushing them to get medical care. And it's, you know, it's sad. Dogs are great.
All right. Well, what else have you been working on this week?
Allison Esposito. This is a bit south, but Allison Esposito, who's trying to unseat Congressman Pat Ryan in the 18th district. I did an analysis with help from a couple other people from the TU about where her campaign contributions come from. We just looked at individual contributions because, you know, people get money from political action committees, PACs. They get money from other people's campaigns. So we just looked at, you know, money that citizens give to see where it came from. We looked at both Esposito's numbers and Pat Ryan's numbers, and it took some number crunching, but we found out that about 3.5% of Esposito's contributions come from within the district she's trying to represent, which is, I mean, I don't have to tell you, it's very low. It's quite low. Pat Ryan, we ran the numbers with him too. His was 36%, 37%. You know, his metrics are a bit better there. He also just raised a lot more money in general. You know, it's if you look at Esposito's, like, where the money came from, a lot of it came from New York City, Westchester, Long Island. Some came from Florida, but only three of the contributions came from within the 18th district. You know, there's still, well, I guess it's not that many months. It's 8 months left, and she still has a lot more to fundraise.
We still don't even know what the congressional lines are yet. We might know later today.
Yeah, yeah. there's all these wrinkles and complications, but... you know, she's really got to kick up her fundraising game. In total, in the last quarter, she raised $250,000. A minority of that was from individual contributions. She got money from other political committees. She got a bunch from Elise Stefanik's political committee. And, you know, some from PACs. But, I mean, Pat Ryan is... A, far outraising her, and B, far, far outraising her as far as individual contributions within the district. And, you know, people know Pat Ryan here more. He was the Ulster County Executive. He ran, before that, he unsuccessfully ran for Congress, and then he represented briefly the 19th district because of the special election with Mark Molinaro. And now he is the congressman. So Esposito is less known than him, but she's going to have to kind of
She ran for lieutenant governor with what's his name that lost to Hochul? What is his name? Long Island Republican.
Oh, I'm totally blanking.
We can't think of it, but it was last time she ran as lieutenant governor candidate, and she lost. And that's basically all I know about her.
Yeah. She doesn't have like a long political career. She spent most of, her life. She's a 25-year veteran of the NYPD. You know, she rose in the ranks to, you know, she did well within the NYPD. She lives in Goshen. It should be mentioned, in Orange County, which is, within the 18th district, but she's got a ways to go because it's not just about like how much money you raise. One of the things the article was trying to point out was that individual contributions are a pretty good indicator for not just support, but like you know how like
enthusiasm.
Yeah, enthusiasm within the district. And if you were to just read these numbers, you'd be like, well, oof, it's not looking good for her.
I'm surprised. I mean, the 18th and the 19th are definitely going to be national battlegrounds.
Yes.
I mean, the New York districts basically flipped Congress to the Republicans in 2022, and the Democrats are definitely going to try to reverse that, and the Republicans are definitely going to try to, I mean, it's razor thin. I mean, it's only three now because Santos is out and Swazi won yesterday or Tuesday.
Yeah. I mean, I feel that the GOP is going to have to put a lot more focus into this race. And, you know, she's getting money from other political candidates like Elise Stefanik. But she's just, like, not as known around here, and that's going to be an uphill battle. She's held some campaign events within the district. One was in, like, Tuxedo. But, you know, I mean, she's fighting against the fact that Pat Ryan has been, like, a political figure in this area for, well, it hasn't been that long, but 6 years, that's certainly a lot longer than her.
It was 2018, that primary, when he lost to Delgado. Yeah. There was, like, six or eight Democrats, and Ryan, I think, finished second, I think, of the, of the six or so.
Like, he was second with the unofficial, there was a little controversy over who got second, but he certainly didn't get first. He was neck and neck with Gareth Rhodes.
Ah.
Yeah. There was, like, only a few votes separating them. And I think, like, with the unofficial election night results, Pat Ryan was second, but then Gareth Rhodes, it was, like, very neck and
very
neck.
Close.
But there was, like, a, you know, and then there was, like, a gap, and Delgado was up there.
I haven't looked at the numbers lately, but in the 19th, Josh Riley, the Democrat who lost to Mark Molinaro last time, is pretty much keeping pace fundraising. The last numbers I saw with Molinaro, they both had a roughly the same amount raised.
Yeah, and that's going to be an interesting race. There's an ad campaign starting today, actually. This is just the latest thing I've heard. Against Josh Riley questioning some of the people that he is associated with, I guess, is, you know, like, the GOP, and they've said this before, because he worked for Al Franken, Senator Al Franken from Minnesota, who exited, according to the press release from the Republicans, in disgrace, because of sexual harassment allegations. They're connecting him to that. And then also his law firm at least partially represented Harvey Weinstein, but that doesn't mean he represented, you know. I have no knowledge that he ever worked directly on the case. But, you know, obviously, I'm not going to say he's a controversial figure, Harvey Weinstein. He's just a terrible person. But, you know, he's just, like, such a legitimate boogeyman that being associated with him is a bad thing.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly the other folks that worked in the book depository being charged with the Kennedy assassination. But they seem to be making allegations just, like, because they worked in the office.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, I guess the argument they're making is, you know, if you are part of a company that does X, if you're not directly involved, you still, I mean, that's for the voters to decide.
All right, anything else you've been working on, or what's coming up, or?
Well, I mentioned the play last week. I'm going to see it on Sunday. This is it. If It Bleeds, It Leads. It's written by Sean Allison, who lives in Hudson.
And at the Park Theater?
Yeah, it's at the Park Theater. They put another date in, is what I'm mentioning, because it was originally only supposed to run last Sunday at 3 o'clock. It's now running this Sunday at 3 o'clock. And last time I checked, which was yesterday, there was tickets still available. So, I don't know, it's a good play. People should check it out. Also working a story... the school state aid to schools, Hochul essentially has gotten rid of a stricture in state government saying that a school district cannot receive less state aid than they did in the prior year. So she got rid of that. And then the foundation aid, which is the largest part of state aid to schools, is being reconfigured. And it was reconfigured in such a way that the three districts that are getting the biggest cuts are all within your listening area. So I'm working on that. It's Oneonta, Hunter Tannersville, and it's Windham, then Onteora, and then Taconic Hills. So that's what I'm working on today. The cuts are huge, by the way. They're all more than a third, like, of state aid for those three districts.
So that's a major cut.
It's a huge cut.
I can't imagine what they're going to do for the May election.
Yeah. I'm talking to the superintendents today to see exactly what this might mean. But basically, it seems that everyone is very up in arms about, you know, no one's going to be supportive of school aid cuts unless there's just a true financial catastrophe, which there really isn't.
It seems it makes sense to, if a school in a year gets a lot smaller enrollment, then maybe they should get a little less funding, but
they should.
I'm not exactly an expert, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's there's a school aid formula, the foundation aid formula, and it's very complicated. But I'm working on that, and everyone can check it out tomorrow.
All right. We've been speaking with Roger Hennigan-Gilson from the Times Union, updating us on what he's been working on this week. Thank you for stopping by, Roger.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. We will be back momentarily on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned. It's not going to...
We started dancing and love put us into our groove. He's on the cutting edge with a menu so refined and a bird on his t-shirt. He's buying flavors always and passing them for free to natives in the dirt. I'm happy for the fox. His guitar almost talks, but I can't hear it very well. He's often seen in a raincoat, jabbering at his employers and warming up the Gazette. He says he'll laugh in a photograph and shave his perfect stubble, but that's probably just a threat. I'm happy for the box. His guitar always talks, but I can't hear it very well. He's mixing up a salad for the solid.
From the WGXC Newsroom, this is the WGXC Daily News. Mid-Hudson News reports that a new report from New York Comptroller Tom DiNapoli found that one in five New York households pay more than half of their household income on housing. Almost 3 million households in the state have housing costs higher than 30% of their household income. DiNapoli said, and I quote, "For too many New Yorkers, finding and keeping an adequate and affordable place to live has been more and more difficult. Rising costs are stretching household budgets and forcing trade-offs with other essentials like food and health care," end quote. New York ranked 32nd in the nation with just a 5.7% increase in housing units between 2012 and 2022. DiNapoli said, and I quote, "The consequences of housing insecurity are wide-ranging, and while low-income renters are the most cost-burdened, these financial pressures are increasingly felt by middle-class households. Action is needed by all levels of government," end quote. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. Andrea Mako reports for Porcupine Soup that Scott M. Ellis Elementary School principal Peter Mahan retired February 13th after two decades with the Greenville School District. Mahan said, and I quote, "It has been an absolute joy to serve the community of Scott M. Ellis Elementary School for over 20 years. During that time, we have experienced tremendous change within our school and within the world. I am grateful to have had the opportunity to recruit and work with so many remarkable faculty and staff members who are fully committed to supporting children as they grow as thinkers, individuals, friends, and citizens," end quote. Joseph Lopez is interim elementary principal through the end of the current school year. The Greenville School District is taking applications for the job through February 25th. And you can read more about this story in Porcupine Soup. Tiffany Greenwald Simon reports for HudsonValley360.com that the Hudson Common Council is considering a resolution opposing the use of 11 Warren Street for county offices. Common Council members complain that Columbia County could get office space almost anywhere. The building is in the city's downtown revitalization district where mixed-use commercial and residential development is favored. Previously, the building was used as offices for the Galvin Foundation, Bard College, and Corec, and the Hudson Youth Clubhouse used the property for the past year. Hudson First Ward Councilmember Gary Perhigan said, and I quote, "When you step back, it's just not a good use at all. The property is very valuable and underutilized. We could do so much more. I would like to see a development that is supported by all stakeholders, that supports meaningful retail and makes sense, and that is welcoming and provides a community use similar to what the clubhouse was doing," end quote. Columbia County Board of Supervisors Chair Matt Murrell said, and I quote, "The building has been purchased by us at a substantial amount of taxpayer money, and our plan is to stay the course," end quote. Meanwhile, the Hudson Common Council will vote on the resolution at its February 20th meeting. And you can read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. And that wraps up the WGXC Daily News. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a pleasant tomorrow.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The Republican-led House will not be jammed or forced into passing a foreign aid bill that was opposed by most Republican senators and does nothing to secure our own border.
House Speaker Mike Johnson might block the Senate passed aid for Ukraine and Israel bill from reaching the floor because it's silent on border security. The White House has reportedly denied Johnson's request to meet with President Joe Biden about migration policy. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan plans to meet with the Gang of Eight, the congressional leaders included in intelligence discussions. House Intelligence Chair Mike Turner says they've learned of a serious national security threat, which reports say is connected to Russian nuclear capabilities. Sullivan is refusing to give details.
I'll leave it to you to draw whatever connections you want. All I can say is I reached out to see Turner. Turner's gone out publicly. I'm going to go see Turner tomorrow. That's where I want to leave things for today.
One is dead and as many as 22 were injured by shootings at Union Station in Kansas City, Missouri. Police arrested three after the attacks at the parade for the Super Bowl winning Chiefs. Missouri Republican Mark Alford reacted to the situation live on CNN.
We should be able to come together in situations like this and celebrate victories, not have to deal with a shooting.
Former Congresswoman and gun violence survivor Gabrielle Giffords is calling for an end to gun violence, pointing out that it's been 6 years since the mass shooting in Parkland, Florida. Kansas City Police Chief Stacey Graves says she's angry because people should feel they can celebrate in safety.
We had over 800 law enforcement officers, Kansas City and other agencies, at the location to keep everyone safe.
Long Island Democrat Tom Suozzi is headed back to Congress to replace disgraced Representative George Santos. California Democrat Pete Aguilar says Suozzi winning again in his old district means one less MAGA vote and a lot less craziness in the House.
It's a return to placing someone in that seat with the dignity to solve problems and to work in a bipartisan way to get things done rather than a sideshow that was George Santos.
Suozzi's return, the Republican majority is down to three, with three vacancies, which could remain empty for some time. Nearly one in five told pollsters working for Monmouth University say they believe the conspiracy theory that pop star Taylor Swift is involved in a covert government plot to help President Biden win re-election. Many who said that are Republicans, and almost three quarters of them also say 2020 was stolen. Flight attendants from three separate unions at the big airlines are picketing airports for new contracts and better pay. Corliss King with Transport Workers Union Local 556 was on the picket line at Chicago O'Hare.
This is the first time that they have seen a showing of like this worldwide of flight attendants who are absolutely determined to command our seat at the table.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. In a game of chicken with the Wisconsin Supreme Court, GOP legislators passed somewhat competitive redistricting maps proposed by Democratic Governor Tony Evers to avoid having truly fair maps forced upon them by the court. Governor Evers' state legislative maps were among seven submitted to the Wisconsin Supreme Court in January after it deemed the GOP-dominated legislature's gerrymandered and non-contiguous maps unconstitutional. In its ruling, it said if the legislature couldn't pass fair maps, the court would pick them instead. A Marquette University analysis showed that the governor's maps were not as competitive and therefore more favorable to a GOP majority than other submissions. The legislature had passed a more partisan version of Evers' maps in January, but it was passed late at night with no public hearing or input. It abandoned those maps when the court's redistricting consultants found them not to be constitutional. In a last-ditch effort to hang on to its power, the GOP majority passed the Evers maps February 13th, again with no public hearing, and included a provision that the maps not be implemented until November 2024. Until then, any special or recall elections would take place under the current gerrymandered maps. The Wisconsin Examiner reports that Governor Evers previously said he would sign the bill if there were no changes. We have more on this evolving story at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Thank you.
You're listening to Samara Lebelski's Split Circuits on the radio.